You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. I'm outside on a phone. It's weird. The internet's off in my house, which is not good when you work from your house. So I'm outside, which I'm just outside because it's nice outside. And I'm on a phone, and hopefully this doesn't look weird. Hopefully.
Things don't feel too swampy in D.C. this summer?
Well, we're taping in the morning, as we like to do. Birds are chirping. It's getting a little humid. I'm still drinking hot coffee. So all is right with the world. And I just got back. I flew in from Gotham this morning. So
excellent.
Good to be back in our nation's capital. I'm not one of those people who hates, rags on Washington, D.C. I like it's named after our best president, next to Reagan. But I flew into Reagan Airport, so I'm happy to be here.
We're hearing the airplanes from Reagan Airport right now. You might not know, Matt, this is a very important week in the history of Calvin Coolidge.
I did not know that.
I don't know if you can quite see on the screen, but I'm wearing my Calvin Coolidge t-shirt, which says, "I do not choose to run," the famous quote he gave.
You can't see it. You have to sort of pull that up a little bit.
There you go. It's not the fanciest shirt in the world. I did get it at the Coolidge Presidential Center in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. So August 2nd, 1923, is when Warren Harding dies at a hotel in San Francisco. I believe actually a hotel next door to where I used to work. Way back in the day, off on New Montgomery Street, and so that was August 2nd. In the wee hours of August 3rd, is when Calvin Coolidge is sworn in by the light of the kerosene lamp at his family's home in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. Sworn in by his father, a notary public.
Was he wearing an Indian headdress at the time?
Well, funny you should mention that, because 4 years later, he escapes the heat of Washington, D.C. for an extended working vacation in South Dakota, where he famously wore that Indian headdress to commemorate a treaty he had signed. I believe it was the treaty. Yeah.
Felt like cultural appropriation to me, but that's just me.
I believe he was doing as asked by the local tribe. And while in South Dakota, on the fourth anniversary of Harding's death and his swearing in, he announces to the press, the traveling press corps, "I do not choose to run for president again," which people, technically speaking, because there was no limit on terms at the time. It was tradition that you didn't run for more than two terms, based on Washington's example. But you know, he only was elected once, but he came in the middle of Harding's term. So, he only had the presidency for a year plus when Harding died. So it wouldn't have been outlandish to go for two terms, but he said, you know, that I'm not going to go do this on a technicality. You shouldn't be president more than 8 years. I'm done.
Did he win a bet that he could announce he wasn't running in eight words or less?
it is. I'm not giving you the entire statement, but it was a very short statement in the classic silent cow mold. Though there is an argument that it was more than just fealty to Washington's example. His son died during his presidency, and arguably triggered a deep depression, which made him not really want to be president anymore.
That was the blister on the tennis court, right?
The blister on the tennis court that got infected. This is before the days of penicillin, and he died from the bacterial infection.
That's amazing.
But that is our history detour for the morning.
All right, guys, our work is done. Tune in next week to History Time with Bill and Matt. That's not a bad idea. There should be a history dialogue. Why isn't there? Why isn't there a dialogue?
Well, I'm sure there's several. I mean, I know there's. I don't know about dialogues, but.
No, I mean Blogging Heads.
Maybe we should do an offshoot. Maybe we need to do a spinoff.
Eventually,
maybe
it's just us.
Maybe we need to rope in Carl Cannon, author of On This Date.
We could do one where you and I do auto calls. People have problems, want to fix their car, they could call in. a home repair dialogue.
And get a history lecture. I actually know nothing about home repair, so since you called in, I can help you. Here's a history lecture.
Well, I guess we should talk about politics as much as I hate doing that, but that's why we make the big bucks.
So Donald Trump was in not your home state, but your adopted home for a time, West Virginia.
And my wife's home state. My wife is from West Virginia. And I went to college in West Virginia,
where he had the big announcement that the governor there, Jim Justice, who is the only billionaire in West Virginia, made his money off of coal and then plowed it into rehabilitating one of their upscale resorts, the Greenbrier.
I've been there. Been there once. Beautiful.
So, in one sense, nothing in this story is about the white working class. Richest man in West Virginia overhauls a fancy resort and then runs for governor on that record. But he parlayed it to, I've created all these jobs. I've made West Virginia an attractive place to visit. But ran as a Democrat. And now...
There's always been like a sort of... connection between like really rich people and working class people, right? Mm-hmm. And then the everyone else is sort of on the other side of that divide, I guess. But you know, it's weird, but it's much more common than we think, you know.
Well, it's really he's a CEO who can say, I have done things for the working class in my area. I'm not someone who's removed from West Virginia society. But apparently he's been having his friction with the Republican state legislature there. This is a state that has long been Democrat, but has definitely been moving more Republican over time. It is the state where Trump had his biggest margin of victory of any state. It was only 20 years ago that Bill Clinton won West Virginia. Mike Dukakis won West Virginia.
Paul Begala told me last night. I just dropped some names here. This was sort of a behind the scenes thing, but I don't think it's anything secret or anything. But he told Begala told me that that Clinton did better in West Virginia than he did in California. So if that tells you anything,
well, California used to be more of a swing state. So you know, this is not far removed from Pete Wilson being governor of California and the Duke. Being the governor of California and anti-immigration ballot initiative passed while Clinton was president. That doesn't surprise me at all. But Al Gore's environmentalism and gun control position turned West Virginia red in 2000 and really hasn't looked back since. And Robert Byrd dies.
Did Bush win West Virginia?
He won. He won both times.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah. No, it hasn't gone blue since 2000.
It must have been narrow in 2000. It must have been a narrow.
I think it was relatively narrow. This is why they argue that, you know, how Al Gore lost Tennessee is the worst candidate in the world. You know, no, it's that there is a shift that's happened in the border south because of coal, because of guns, and tobacco.
Tennessee, probably.
Yeah.
It wasn't that long ago that West Virginia was like really, really blue, and Republicans couldn't get elected there.
Right.
And I think, rarely could they. And you know, my college has like a statue of like Robert C. Byrd or something.
Right.
I mean, it came in after I left, and I'm gonna start a sort of social. I need to start like a campaign to get it taken down, because I think we could argue that. Some of his past Klan behavior. I mean, I feel like on college campuses we could stir up some, you know, some trouble about Robert C. Byrd, you know, getting his name taken down from that.
I'm not gonna have another Robert Byrd debate with you. but West Virginia is sort of this classic Trump state where a lot of white working class folks that have not been served well by globalization and modernization. At least the perception is that's the case. People who are not necessarily anti-government, you know, don't necessarily mind having government provide. Robert Byrd was the classic case sort of who could deliver the bacon, but being distrustful of current government so long as they are pushing clean energy and not
Trump
coal.
Is pretty much the perfect candidate, for
right?
Them, right, I would say.
And even in West Virginia, very few people have coal jobs. And the coal factories that remain are very automated, but there still is a nostalgia about it, a part of the cultural fabric. There's actually a great history podcast called Road to Now that had a West Virginia professor talk about the history of coal, arguing that, you know, West Virginia wasn't always tied to coal. Before coal was mined, it was seen as a very modern economy that was diversifying in manufacturing, and it got kind of stuck to coal. And now it needs to diversify because coal's not going to be there forever, and politicians like Trump are holding that process back in a way.
Did you ever see that Rocket Boys moot book? You know what I'm talking about?
No.
It was called October Sky. They changed the title. But Homer Hickam wrote this book about what it was like growing up in a West Virginia mine town. And you had like company, you had to buy stuff at the company store. And he actually was inspired by, I guess, the Sputnik launch, which inspired, you know, Americans to try to get to the moon and all that. And he ended up, you know, getting into rockets in West Virginia. And I guess he went to, he won, you know, some sort of an award and scholarships and stuff. But the book and the movie are about how, like, his dad wanted him to work in the mine and thought it was a waste of time to do the science stuff and the struggles that he had to overcome.
I mean,
check it out.
That sounds good. I saw an anecdotal report at ABC during the campaign about a young man in West Virginia who took advantage of a government retraining program, and he was like, this is great, I work in an office now, I'm not getting black lung, this is fantastic.
I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you, but you keep saying interesting things. there was a Washington Post story a couple months ago, and it was about this like African-American nurse in somewhere in West Virginia, and it was like a profile of her and the people that she takes care of. And there was a piece in the story that said, like, when you call up the office, like, it said, like, press 1 if you have black lung, you know, if you're calling about black lung disease. Press 2 if you want to find out about office hours, you know? I mean, like, that's how common it is.
Right.
Actually, literally, it's like the first thing on the phone.
And there actually is a history of West Virginia politicians railing against the coal executives for not treating their workers properly. So it's not like that element of politics doesn't still exist. There's a guy running for Senate right now. I'm sorry, his name just escaped me, but he famously confronted Hillary Clinton at a little roundtable thing that was invite only. And he's like, how dare you say you're going to kill all these coal jobs? Because he was an unemployed coal miner himself. And he's running for Senate now, which is against Joe Manchin, but it's a contested Republican primary. And in his introductory video, you know, he talks about how when he confronted Hillary, people come up to him and said, "Hey, you know, you're speaking for all of us. You're not just speaking for the coal executive. You're speaking for the workers too." So that element of Western politics still remains.
I should disclose, Bill. I don't know if I've told you this. I probably have. My wife is fundraising for one of the people running.
Not that guy though, right? You're Evan Jenkins.
No, Evan Jenkins, he's running again. So my wife's working for Patrick Morrison, Attorney General.
Right, okay.
And so, Jenkins is the he's running against Jenkins in the primary.
Right.
Jenkins is a congressman there now.
And the third guy doesn't hold office, and I apologize for forgetting his name.
I didn't know there was a third.
Oh, you? Well, your wife better know.
Oh, she probably does. See, people probably assume that I know a lot about what she does, but I disclose it, you know, for the sake of like transparency. But like the idea that I actually know a lot about what's going on in a
Wait. I go through this whole tour of West Virginia political history to get to the fact that all the troubles Trump is having, can't get health care passed, tax reform hasn't really advanced, Mueller's breathing down his neck, having to do the chief of staff swap, which is not, doesn't seem to have resolved internal tension in the administration. He goes to the state that gave him the biggest margin of any state, celebrates the fact that he flipped the governor from Democrat to Republican. But all this does nothing to actually resolve any of his problems in Washington. I mean, you can't preach any more to the choir than going to West Virginia for Donald Trump. This does not change a senator's vote. This does not solve any kind of legislative puzzle. This does not deal with his investigative troubles. This does not deal with the palace intrigue. This is getting bathed by the deepest loyalist of your base and touting a governor's flip. You know, that doesn't help you in Washington by any stretch. The Trump attitude has always been double down the base only, dance to the one you brung you, keep the loyalists happy. And so his poll numbers have dropped now to more like 36 than 42, neither number which is very good. But it's always been, if you keep that hard 36, you can't go over the edge. You can't get impeached. You're not going to have a serious primary challenge. The Republicans in Washington can't break ranks all that easily if you got the base there. But clearly, there are limitations to that strategy.
Yes. And I would also say, on top of the fact that he went to West Virginia and to celebrate this Democratic governor becoming a Republican, you also had the stock market breaking records this week. So, I mean, it's really a tale of two presidencies. You know, you could argue that, like, there's great things happening. If all you did was watch Fox News and all you knew was that he gave this speech in West Virginia where the governor is becoming a Republican and the stock market's doing, like, if that's all you knew, you would say, wow, this is really amazing.
Yeah, when the stock market did well under Bush, the line from Carl Rove and others was, this is great for everybody. So many more Americans have 401ks. So it's not just the top 1% benefiting. This is great for all Americans. When Obama, the market did well under Obama, I mean, the market recovered dramatically well after the crash of 2008. It was, oh, Barack Obama is celebrating the muckety mucks of Wall Street. They're living it up. And the working class is getting the short end of the stick. And all that's happening now is an extension of the bull market that was under Obama. I mean, Trump has literally done nothing. There is nothing that has passed in Washington. Well,
didn't the market go up, though, like as soon as he was elected president?
Well, it just kept going. It wasn't like it was in free fall before the election day and spiked up just for him.
Hillary had been elected, I wonder what would have happened if we would be where we are.
I think the market has done well under Democrat presidents generally. The market tanked at the end of the Bush presidency. There was a giant crash with Ronald Reagan in his second term.
And I would say this, I think Trump, he may be peaking, the market may be peaking a little early.
What I think particularly strange about Trump, and granted, I mean, Trump's con is always, you know, sell what you can sell and ignore what hurts you.
Yeah.
It's just a constant trying to stay ahead of facts and reality. But Obama had this problem in his first term when they had their recovery summer theme. And then when the economy, you know, wasn't all that robust, that was used to mock him. Clearly, you're at the tail end of a very long running bull market. You have to be worried that the boom bust cycle is going to bite you.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean,
and Obama always. Even with the recovery summer business, Obama always tried. I mean, you could say he didn't walk the tightrope well, but they always tried to say things are getting better. They are not better for everybody. We have more work to do. That was all. That was the line throughout the entire 8 years. And Trump doesn't leaven anything. You know, he just sells. It seems it's more bifurcated. I mean, he will talk about, you know, Obamacare is dying and it's going to implode and it's killing everybody, and that's happening like on a wholly separate track of stock market's great, Foxconn's coming to Wisconsin, everything's coming up roses. Man, what are all these wonderful things that I've done? When, you know, there's no change in government spending or, you know, government cutting. You know, you can talk about deregulation, but he's only passed a handful of very minor Congressional Review Act bills that scotched late regulations of Obama that weren't even implemented yet. So this has been deregulated that's actually been part of the American fabric at all. And there's nothing on the horizon that's going to get through Congress. Anyone being serious and being fair would have to say the continuation of the Obama economy is not due to Trump. Obviously, his base is not going to accept that. He has to worry that he's got nothing in the pipeline that could either extend this or any way for him to take credit for. I mean, you could say if it busted, just as I can say it's not his fault now, that it's not his fault later, because he's just not a factor. But he surely will get blamed if things go down his watch, because he's trying to take credit for so much as it is.
Yep, I think that's true. So I was watching, you know, some of the West Virginia speech, and you see Trump. So, you know, yes, sort of a confluence of things happening yesterday, right? So you've got the thing where Trump is the leaks that exposed him talking to, like, the president of Mexico about building the wall, and that sort of showed him to be very cynical and much more concerned with appearances than substance. You had the grand jury announcement, and you had Trump giving that speech in West Virginia. And in the speech, he sort of talks about how the game is rigged and the deep state's out to get him. And I do think that these three stories do pose somewhat of a problem. I do think that if Mueller finds some sort of business irregularities that are not Russia specific, that the predicate has now been laid amongst at least about a third of the country that they're out to get him, that they want to nullify the election results. And I'm not saying this because I think that Mueller should like not investigate a crime if he finds one, but I do think it's worth noting that, you know, and by the way, the interesting thing is James Comey, this fear is sort of the similar fear that led him to do what he did. He was afraid that if it came out after the election that he had been investigating, you know, Hillary, but had not announced it, that people would feel like the fix was in and the game was rigged. And that led him, at least speculation is that led him to make the announcement. But it is I think it's not an absurd fear. You know, we already have polarization. We already have a lot of distrust of institutions in America. And, I do think it's very possible that a lot of the country might end up, feeling like, you know, like there is a deep state that took down a president or tried to take down a president.
Well, anytime you're talking about potential impeachment, it's going to be polarizing. There's going to be hardcore partisans on each side that get exercised. The impeachment of President Clinton was enormously polarizing.
But don't you think it's worth? I agree. But I just feel like the country's in kind of a worse state now, and people, you know, when Clinton was impeached, there wasn't this alternate universe of media outlets that that people could basically just, there wasn't like, I mean, you had like Rush Limbaugh and stuff like that, but you had talk radio but there wasn't like this like alternate universe of information. Now I feel like the problem's worse, and and it could be more dangerous.
Well, I agree. I mean, I don't know if dangerous is the word I would use, but I agree that we're in a deeper state of polarization. I see it as connected to the Clinton years. That's really, I think, the beginning of this generation of polarization. You didn't have as high levels of disapproval of Reagan and George H.W. Bush, even when they're, you know, I mean, George H.W. Bush ended up being very unpopular, but you still had periods where, I mean, you know, Reagan won by an enormous landslide in 84. Bush won, you know, decisively in 88 and was wildly popular in the aftermath of the Gulf War. It was only the recession that brought him down. So it wasn't like there was this deep polarization where you had this bedrock group that couldn't budge no matter what the circumstances were. You know, even Democrats were perfectly happy with the outcome of the Gulf War at the time. With Bill Clinton comes in the early 90s and, you know, the Arkansas Project, SCAFE, the American Spectator, Rush Limbaugh, you know, they're at him from the get-go. Whitewater, Travelgate, all that stuff's happening. You know, Vince Foster, that's happening right away. And I think that's continued, you know, from then on with I think, a brief unity tour after 9/11. Outside of that, it's been polarization, you know, the whole way through. The fracturing of our media, you know, begins with the internet in the 90s. So we're at that kind of a mature, quote unquote, point in that trajectory. I think the worse this gets for Trump, the more potentially polarized the country gets, unless, and this is a big if, you know, people really have the goods on Trump, and even some of the hardcore have to say, all right, I see it now. There's no way out of this one. This is clearly crime's been committed. It might not get to that point, but it depends on what the gun is.
Okay, so my take would be, and I don't want to, you know, these are purely hypotheticals here, okay? So I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but just hypothetically, you know, look, I mean, there's some study or whatever that said that, you know, all of us commit 3 felonies a day, like average people, not like unknowingly. If someone just followed you around all, you know, you just have to imagine that somebody who's a casino magnate in that business and like operating in New Jersey and all, you know, Atlantic City, that, you know, if you do enough prodding around and you subpoena tax records and, you know, emails, that it's pretty likely you might come up with something, right? It seems pretty likely.
Right, I mean, if we end up with like an Al Capone tax evasion thing,
yeah,
the Trump base will be livid. They will not accept that as a legitimate. Not saying Mueller shouldn't do it if that's what happens, that would be a natural political reaction.
Right, and my concern is like, A, if Mueller stumbles across something that's illegal, he can't just look the other way. On the other hand, I really think that a lot of Americans really, you would have a legitimate argument to say, like, we elected this guy, they decided to take him down, and that's what they did, and that is undemocratic, and that is dangerous.
I mean, they're gonna say that, but of course, you know, people are gonna
have an argument. They would have an argument if that happened.
Well, you look at what happened with Clinton. You know, people going after real ticky-tack stuff like Travelgate. That suggested we want to choose because it's illegitimate from the get-go on the most, you know, thin grounds possible. Yeah, the impeachment was over perjury, trying to cover up an affair, and Republicans at the time treated it as if like the entire fabric of democracy was at stake.
Right.
We're
Democrats, but okay, I concede all that, but we're Democrats circa 1998 as paranoid and defensive. And I'm not saying that we should change the way that we do things based on the fact that how someone else might react, right? But for the sake of conversation, were Democrats circa 1998 as susceptible and vulnerable to sort of coming apart as Trump fans are in 2017?
I mean, the dynamic's a little different because your impeachment was politically beneficial to Clinton. Not only did Clinton partisans stick by him, but a lot of, you know, a lot of the swing was like, what are you doing, guy? The economy's great. This, you had an affair, so what? Why are you freaking out about this? Jeez, people, get over it. Get a grip. This is, you know, Trump potentially will be the first president to never clear 50% in a Gallup approval poll. From literally from day one, it started at 45 and has only bounced between 36 and 42 generally ever since. The root of the investigation is, did Trump collude with an enemy country? You know, that is a far more serious basis for investigation than an affair or a ticky-tack land deal. So this is somewhat more analogous to Watergate, which didn't deal with, you know, collusion with an enemy, but dealt with, political subterfuge. And there were Nixon partisans that said, you know, this is all trumped up. You know, this is all just basic political activity that they're blowing out of proportion. And that hardcore partisan faction was about 20% of the country. You know, now it's about a third of the country, a little bit more than a third of the country that feels that way. It's not really close to a majority. And it certainly would make things tense, but I don't think it's the downfall of the Republic if there's a third of the country that you know, can't see things for the way they are.
You may be more optimistic than me. I don't think it's a downfall of the country, but I think it's challenging. I hope the audio in this show is okay, Bill.
I hear the planes, but I hear you.
Lawnmowers, planes.
Lawnmowers, bugs. Lawnmowers I don't really hear, but we hear right. The planes. But your inside, well, your inside rings loud and clear.
Through the din. I've been told that I'm loud, that I have a loud voice. I just hope, you know, I know that our audience here has become accustomed to, you know, really professional quality performances from us. And so
have we ever gone through a show without a technical problem? I don't think that's possible. but before we go, I do want to talk one other subject with you. And that is this new book from Senator Jeff Flake.
Yes.
Conscience of a Conservative, which is echoing the title of Barry Goldwater's book, also an Arizona senator. Excerpted in Politico earlier this week, where he says that Republicans have been in denial about Trump. They've tried to ignore the tweets, and he puts himself in this category, trying to say, I'm not going to just comment on every tweet, but then basically says, look, that's not tenable. He's eroding Democratic norms. He's violating conservative principles, and hurting the Republican Party's long-term prospects. And he ends on that Republicans should stand up to Trump when he does things, when he plays to the base, quote unquote, in ways that hurt the ability for the Republican Party to reach out to other groups. They should oppose Trump on trade. They should be free traders and not be protectionists. And they should not give in to Trump's demands to eliminate the filibuster and allow for essentially more bipartisanship in legislating. And he says this is... So you had a lot of folks on the left being very dismissive of this, saying,
yeah,
you didn't vote for, you didn't stand for Obamacare, you're trying to, you voted for Trump 95% of the time, you support the lion's share of his agenda, this is all posturing. And what I think they're missing is Flake is saying Trump is undermining conservatism And conservatives need to stand up to him when he is violating conservative principles and democratic norms. Now, having said that, and actually Flake is also being very pro-immigrant. He's like you, Matt, and he's being supportive of immigration in line with conservatism. He talks in the book about how he protected undocumented immigrants on his ranch from being deported. And so this week, after this book comes out, Trump comes out with a plan to slash legal immigration, capping legal immigration, making things more merit-based. And Flake has a tweet, a very milquetoast tweet that says, "Why, I also agree we should have more merit-based elements in our immigration. I don't agree with, you know, Trump's legislation." It's like that. This is your confrontation. His aide is literally echoing white nationalist themes, and that's your confrontation. You know, he didn't say anything about Trump when he played at the police rally, saying we should mistreat criminal suspects and rough them up in the back of police cars. He didn't say anything about the Boy Scout rally and politicizing the Boy Scout rally. I mean, these are the sorts of bending of norms that he said, going on his standard.
Well, it's also interesting, if you had a book coming out, that might be a good thing to hop on, right?
Right.
Just for the sake of promotion, it's consistent with your book, and you would want to jump on that. Like, but even if, you know.
But he still seems very conflicted. I mean, I think it's wrong for the left to say, don't hold him to a liberal standard, because he's not holding himself out. I mean, if you want to say we should oppose Flake's reelection because he voted to repeal Obamacare, I mean, that's fine. I mean, that's a legitimate turf to battle him on. But
well, the problem with doing what Jeff Flake's doing, and by the way, let me just say, I agree with most of, I haven't read the book, but I've read the excerpts. I agree with most of what he has to say. And I think it's very consistent with my book that I wrote, you know, before Trump was elected. But the problem with doing it, with doing this as an elected official, is that that the left and liberals will never give you credit if you're actually a conservative, right? So if you're like pro-life, you want low taxes, but you want to do entitlement reform, and you want you know, immigrants to assimilate, you know, you're not like an alt-righter, liberals will never give you credit. I mean, most of them won't. Intellectually honest people like you, of course, will, Bill, but it's not in the best interest of the left to do that, because they don't like conservatism, even good conservatism. There is no good conservatism for them. And then half your base or more of your own base will be pissed off, right? So it's really a lose-lose proposition. You know, you can't make friends of your enemies by making enemies of your friends, kind of thing.
Well,
so it's now, I did it because I'm not a politician, and so aside from like believing what I wrote, it's actually a much better business move for someone like me than it is for Flake, because I don't need to win an election. If I can, you know, contribute to a discussion and generate ideas and buzz, like that's a win. But Flake is in trouble. I mean, at least some of the, was it a PPP poll?
Yeah.
Showed that he is very unpopular in Arizona right now.
Right. He hasn't gained Democratic support. He's been losing Republican support. His approval, I think, was in the low 20s. So
he's up this cycle, right?
Yeah, this is a real gamble on his part.
Yeah,
to stick his neck out like this. And Arizona is a state that's been trending purple. That's a state that Hillary did better than Obama in, even though she came up short in 2016.
I agree, and I'm trying to interview him. I'm hoping to get to interview him. I think I probably agree with almost everything he says. I admire him for saying it, but I think if I'm advising him, I say, you know, Jeff, baby, let's put this out in 2018, in 2019, yeah. So, interesting decision from a political standpoint.
Well, to that end, I mean, clearly Flake's not a moron. He knows, I mean, you know, John McCain had a primary challenge from the right. He knows there is a tightrope to walk between the far right in Arizona and the moderate tint in the general election. He must know the risk he's taking in pointing this out at this time. Do you think he is doing this knowing this might be the end of his political career in Arizona? And perhaps that means he has larger ambitions that he wants. Maybe if he loses for doing this, he can then portray himself as a martyr for maybe not centrism, but a martyr for rational conservatism that he could parlay into some kind of national bid in 2020.
Evan McMullen, hardest hit.
Right.
look, who knows? But that would be my, if I had to speculate on the different rationale, like, that's the most plausible one for me, is that this is a profile in courage. He seems like the kind of person who prides himself on sort of doing the right thing and being courageous. And that's the most plausible theory that's better than the notion that he doesn't realize this is dangerous, which would make him stupid, which he's not stupid. It's better than the notion that he thinks this is good politics in Arizona right now. I mean, it seems like the most plausible, you know, scenario.
So, for someone like you, a never Trump conservative, did not vote for you. Maybe you like that the phrase. You didn't vote for Trump. You didn't vote at all in 2016. Flake says in the book that he did not vote for Trump. You have laid out your vision in the book Too Dumb to Fail, which everyone should still read. It continues to
available.
Be relevant.
Available in paperback.
but by the hardcover, because it's nicer, you know? It is.
Also, I read the audiobook. It's actually me.
That's
so
right.
Get that, too.
You want to see a intellectual conservatism, a fact-based conservatism. You are troubled by the direction Donald Trump is taking things. If Evan McMullen can't be the standard bearer because he doesn't have the stature, do you, Matt Lewis, throw your lot in with Flake? Are you a Flake conservative?
I mean, if Jeff Flake, I mean, you know, I don't have posters of him hanging up in my house. I think I'm more of like a Ben Sasse, Marco Rubio kind of, you know.
But they're all sort of, in theory, the same pool. Although, I mean, people have mentioned, you know, Ben Sasse wrote a book that you reviewed.
Yeah.
But, and he has held himself up as an intellectual conservative, never Trump conservative. But he has steered clear of direct confrontation with Trump since he won. And the book, you know, totally circumvents all of those controversies. Flake is taking the more politically risky route in saying head on, Trump is anathema to conservatism and needs to be called out on it.
I think in a way, Sasse's direction might actually be the shrewder long-term political strategy. But sometimes shrewd isn't the most. I mean, the profile and courage may not always be the one that's rewarded. Look, I'll say this, Bill. I've pretty much given up on the idea that anytime soon that the Republican Party is going to like right itself. I mean, I guess it's possible that Trump could be so discredited that the party would turn its lonely eyes to a Sasse. And I think he would actually be in a way better positioned having not gone after Trump as hard, having distanced himself from Trump, but not going after Trump in a way. He would be, if that were to happen, and I don't think it's going to happen, but if that were to happen, if Trumpism were discredited and if the conservative base, which I don't think they would do, said, oh, we made a mistake, we need to go a different direction, then I think you're better positioned by having distanced yourself from him but not excoriated him. But I don't think any of that's going to happen. I think that this sorting and reordering is just going to get worse, that essentially what we're seeing the West Virginia story. I mean, if you are a working class white guy, and if you're like a union guy, if you're like, you know, a coal miner or what, you know, you're a Republican now. And the less college, the more likely. And so basically my point is, like, all the trends that would lead people, all the trends that would lead the Republican Party to decide to go after my rootless cosmopolitan brand of conservatism, as Stephen Miller might say, they're cutting against us. Like, it really feels like we are entering into an era where the Republican Party is going to be a party of solely of, you know, non-college educated working class whites. And don't get me wrong, love those people, should be part of your coalition, but solely is the problem. And rural, more rural, more male, more non-college, more, you know, and so I think that, like, it's less likely now than it was a year, even a year or two ago, that that, like, my side would win out in this internecine struggle.
That is, I think, a thoughtful note to end on.
Do you agree? Do you agree?
I think I would maintain that it is long-term untenable for the Republican Party to be a white working class only party.
Yeah. You know, at some point, there just aren't enough. The math doesn't work at some point. Right?
I mean, I have to hesitate. I mean, that's a view I would have held very strongly before 2016. I got to pause now and think, okay.
Well, I mean, it could be 20 years.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody was saying that, like, it's untenable. It can't last, you know, another year or two. No, I mean, you know, because who votes? You know, old people vote. You know, and then you've got the fact, you've got the Electoral College that factors into this. You can win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote. You can have all sorts of Hispanics voting in California, and it doesn't matter. You're gonna lose California. It doesn't matter if you lose it by one vote or 20 million votes. So there's a lot of things that are factoring into the fact that the Trump coalition could deliver victories for a lot longer than people might think if they were solely looking at demographics.
Yeah, I mean, demographic changes move very slowly, so I wouldn't necessarily assume that the Trump coalition couldn't, in theory, hold for, maybe not 20 years, but for some short-term period of time. Where I am more optimistic/pessimistic is, you know, Trump is doing so little to deliver. I mean, and I believe the lion's share of his base doesn't care because they're happy just fighting the culture war, broadly defined, and they don't necessarily need to see certain policy pieces become law. But I don't think
should point out that making matters worse, what? You know, sort of expediting this, is the culture war, and the fact that it's real, and the fact that you've got, you know, maybe you say anecdotal, but, like, plenty of examples of people on the left. Like, the latest is Lena Dunham, right? You probably saw it. Like, Lena Dunham reported to American Airlines that she overheard some American Airlines reporters saying, quote, transphobic things. And so she dropped a dime on them, reported them to American Airlines, and American Airlines is going to launch an investigation into this. Into what probably was, if it even occurred, a private conversation where people may or may not have expressed politically incorrect opinions that she happened to overhear. Again, I mean, totally, it's probably an overblown story, but it's the kind of thing that if you're like that, you know, guy in Ohio or something, or West Virginia, like, you can't be in the same party with those people.
Well, I mean,
like,
that
by
was,
those people, I mean Lena Dunham.
Well, I mean, that's why, you know, George Bush was able to be in office for 8 years, or at least partly. But there came a point where, however you fell along culture war lines, you saw Katrina, you saw Iraq, you saw a global economic meltdown, and you said, "Forget it. It's just the world is burning. I need to flip."
But Obama also came across as very, and maybe he is. I mean, but Obama presented a very, like, in some ways, moderate alternative.
No,
right?
he navigated the minefield very deftly, but
yeah.
but not by abandoning all traces of multiculturalism.
Right.
You know, there are certain aspects where he tread very carefully, but it wasn't like he said, I'm going to be anti-gay to win over
Obama,
voters.
But Obama created like a permission structure, whereas Hillary reinforced the culture war.
Well, yeah, she did not. There are certain things she did, particularly in terms of race and Black Lives Matter, in terms of guns, in terms of immigration. She leaned in a lot harder than Obama did, but there was plenty of cultural liberalism bound up in Obama in the beginning. He was not running as a blue dog. I think Obama was able to do that because a lot of people who might be seen as anti-PC types, you know, just didn't care because all these other things were going on that were more dominant.
Yeah,
there was a focus group that got leaked out where it was a Republican focus group and they were pushing Bill Ayers stuff on Obama. And the person, I don't care who we palled around with, I need to get some health care. You know, that attitude would not have played in 2016. So my point is, as of today, nothing's happening that's so dramatic that's going to get people to deprioritize broader culture war stuff. But if Donald Trump mishandles a public health crisis like a Zika epidemic, or he stumbles into an unnecessary war, or there is some sort of, you know, other sort of Katrina-like disaster,
yeah,
you know, that's gonna scramble things again, I would think.
I would say that the global economic meltdown, Katrina, and the Iraq War were...
It's a pretty big trifecta.
An axis of evil. I mean, it's hard to... you can have one major mistake, but to have three, you know, one being a natural disaster that turned into a big mistake.
I mean, Ronald Reagan had the Lebanon bombing.
Yeah.
And I think it was 83. I know it was first term. I mean, that was pretty bad. and directly attributable to bad decisions on his administration's part. But the economy had recovered from the 82 recession, and Democrats could not make hay out of that, even though they tried.
Plus, Reagan pulled out of that pretty quick, too.
I mean, Reagan had other things. Right, there are other things that he did to lean on to overcome whatever crisis that had happened on his watch. Trump is there are no hedges with Trump. It's all just culture war prosecution, no actual governing, no actual policy, and that's maybe fine for now. Maybe can escape midterm disaster because that base is going to show up. But I think at some point, actual governing has to occur if you're going to maintain what for Trump is a very tenuous coalition. It's not like he won with 60%. He won with a minority coalition distributed just so. And if the governing doesn't actually pan out, that could easily break apart.
Well, this is why people watch this show. Another sterling episode. Always deliver.
What can people? What do you want to plug before we sign off?
Oh, just check all my stuff out at the Daily Beast, and check out the podcast Matt Lewis and the News, and follow us here on Twitter at DMZ Show.
I have a Real Clear Politics column from Monday this week. Why Republicans can't govern with Republicans alone. So check that out, and I got a couple things in the queue for Politico that are not quite fully baked yet, but keep an eye out.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll see you back here next week in the DMZ.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.